BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one, we'll test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, the meaning of the word sumptuary, S-U-M-P-T-U-A-R-Y, sumptuary.
Well, it must be to do with sumptuous.
Yes, roughly.
It's to do with luxury.
Yes, not only luxury, but how you get the luxury.
Ah, expense.
Yes, absolutely right. 2 marks it is. Dennis Norden, what is a roo-raddy? R-U-E hyphen R-A-double-D-Y. Roo-raddy.
Oh, there's another one of those very useful words.
It is quite useful.
A roo-raddy is a feeling you experience about 3/4 hour after eating radishes.
No help so
is
far.
Is it roo as in the plant, roo?
I don't think either word is the faintest help to you at all.
Oh, yes. That's that just makes the whole darn thing worthwhile. I'm going to surrender right away.
I think it's a frightful word. It's a belt or a rope you pass over your shoulder in order to drag something with. Nobody knows what it comes from. Faintly nautical, I think. Anne Scott James. Anne, what is potamology? P-O-T-A-M-O-L-O-G-Y. Potamology.
Well, a hippopotamus is a river horse.
Yes.
And I suppose the hippo part must be the horse, so this must be the science of rivers.
Absolutely right. 2 marks it is. Potamology is the scientific study of rivers. Frank Muir, what is a dunt? D-U-N-T. Dunt.
It's a word. like any other.
Any other. Frequently used by parents, saying, don't use that sort of language.
Don't answer me back.
It's the sort of thing you get when your car is fast but has inadequate brakes.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes, you're right.
It's a dent in the front.
Yes, I was encouraging on that one. There's a variant word in the North Country, dunch, D-U-N-C-H, which you might know. It's not very unlike it.
Dunch is halfway between dinner and lunch.
Not trying.
It's a stone in the road when you're driving.
No, originally it was a firm but rather dull-sounding blow, not rather like crunch. It could be a beat of the heart, but more recently it's been used technically, and this is what I thought possibly Frank might have heard, a blow given to an aircraft by a vertical current of air which it suddenly encounters.
By golly, your hints were helpful.
Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation form to write down, and I want the 2 women members of the team to go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme I shall ask where the quotations come from. Dennis Power and Frank Muir, here's yours. People who live in glass houses should never throw stones. And Anne Scott, James and Dennis, yours is wait till the sun shines, Nelly. And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is a round of words of similar type, which have got different meanings. 2 marks, can you give me the different meanings of these? Dillis Powell, nutria and nutrient. N-U-T-R-I-A and nutrient.
Nutria is a form of fur.
Yes.
I always think rather disagreeable, brown fur.
Comes from what?
I do hope nobody's wearing it.
Comes from what?
Comes from a...
newt.
Whipped from them whilst drunk.
It's rather larger than the newt, but it's equally aquatic.
Beaver. the beaver.
It's a kind, yes, it's not a bad
kind of beaver.
Well, get on to nutrient.
A nutrient is something which feeds one, which nourishes one.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike nutria.
Two marks, I think, all right. Nutria is the skin or fur of the animal called the coypu, which is an aquatic rodent. Nutrient is something that serves as or provides nourishment, as Lily said. Two marks. Dennis Norden, Hoggit and Hoggin. H-O-double-G-E-T and H-O-double-G-I-N. Hoggit, Hoggin.
Hoggit is something that used to be mentioned in the far-off days of the fat stock price.
Yes.
Hoggett and Shearling, or Serling.
Yes.
Hoggett and Serling.
Hoggets and Shearlings.
All right. Attach the right animal to the shearing, and you're there.
Hoggett. Well, is it sheep?
Yes.
It's a sheep. It's a sort of teenage sheep.
Yes. and Hoggin.
Hoggin. I don't know what it is, Hoggin. I've only heard it in the plural, and with the H dropped.
Well, one out of two. Okay. Hoggett is a yearling sheep. Before its first shearing, and Dennis is quite right about that. Hoggin is a mixture of sand and gravel. That's quite simply. One out of two.
You need more hoggin on your drive.
And Scott James, plutocracy and plutolatry. L-A-T-R-Y. Plutocracy, plutolatry.
Plutolatry. Well, it's all to do with the rich.
Yes.
Plutocracy is government by the rich.
Yes.
And plutolatry is adoration of the rich.
Absolutely right. Two marks straight away. Plutocracy, well, either the rule of the wealthy or a ruling or influential class of thoroughly wealthy people. And plutolatry is when you worship mere wealth. And now, Frank Muir, Sari and Sarong. S-A-R-I and S-A-R-O-N-G.
Well, the main difference is that they're both garments. The sari is on both shoulders. And the... So, yes, I think so. At least one.
One.
It can be two, I think, but at least one. And the sarong is halfway up Dorothy Lamour.
Yes.
That's many.
Sari is Indian.
Yes.
And can often be decorated and is celebrated in song in the sari with a fringe on top. And the sarong can be is really Pacific Islands. And... is celebrated in song in My Sarong Goes Round the World. One sarong, I have but one sarong.
Right, okay, mostly have more than one. But two marks anyway. Sari is a length of cotton or silk, which is wrapped round the whole body. I think one shoulder being left out usually. And it's the main garment for Hindu ladies. Sarong is the national garment of Malay. It is also a strip of sometimes striped cotton or silk. Tucked in round the waist, and that's why Frank is quite right. It starts a bit lower down. So wrong. Two marks. In this next round, I give you a line from a poem, and I want you to give me, for 3 marks, the line that comes before it, that immediately precedes it, and second, the title of the poem, and third, the name of the poet. So I'm going to quote a line. I want the line before it. Lillis Powell, man never is, but always to be blessed.
Pope?
Yes.
Pope.
Yes.
Pope. Something...
Man never is...
Hope springs eternal in the human breast.
Yes. You've got it. Do you remember which poem? It's not very difficult.
Essay.
Essay on man.
Yes. Alexander Pope's Essay on Man. Dennis Norden, Let the Lave Go By Me.
Oh, yeah. This is Robert Louis Stevenson...
Yes.
It's give to me the life I love, let the lave go by me. And it's something, it's like the song of the open road. It's that sort of title. I can't remember what the title is.
That's near enough, I think. 3 marks. Robert Louis Stevenson, Songs of Travel, it's a thing, particular thing called The Vagabond. Give to me the life I love, let the lave go by me. And then he does a lot of sort of camping out of doors. 3 marks. Anne Scott James, like those Nicaean barks of yore, N-I-C-E-A-N, like those Nicaean barks of yore, Y-O-R-E.
That's there's glory that was...
That's right.
Glory that was, you know...
Greed. Oh, is it Macaulay?
No, it isn't.
Helen, thy beauty is to me like the Nicaean barks of yore.
Quite right.
that something's sailing in the night, you know. An Edgar Allan flower pot, yeah.
Yes, well, between you, you're all there. 3 marks. It's,
I think I did The Golden Treasury.
Edgar Allan Poe, Poem to Helen, and it does end, as Dennis quite rightly said, to the glory that was Greece and the grandeur that was Rome. Now, Frank Muir. And a small cabin built there of clay and wattles made.
It's Yeats, isn't it? It's Yeats. It's a short but telling poem of an Irishman wishing to be somewhere nicer.
Yes.
And the first line goes, I think, I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree.
Yes.
Because the Lake Isle of Innisfree is your actual title for the piece.
That's right. 3 marks it is, Frank Muir. Now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. Dennis Bauer, people who live in glass houses should never throw stones.
It's a proverb.
Yes, but it appears in English books at various stages.
Hayward.
No.
George Herbert.
Yes. Hello. George Herbert, writing a collection of proverbs called Jacula Prudentium, whose house is of glass must not throw stones at another, and it comes later in a dramatist called Shadwell, later still in Benjamin Franklin, and finally is quoted by George Bernard Shaw. And I and Scott James, the origin of your quotation, please. Wait till the sun shines, Nellie.
Well, I think it was on the... when they'd had a quarrel on a dull day, it was what King Charles II said to Nell Gwynne. Before saying to his followers, look after poor Nellie.
It's rather later Nellie, I think, this one.
It's a song.
It's a song.
A song?
Yep. It was composed by a chap called Harry von Tiltzer. It was written in 1905, and he was a leading publisher of songs. He published the first songs by Irving Berlin and George Gershwin.
He was also quite notable, and he wrote a song called That Old Irish Mother of Mine.
Oh.
Which is quite an achievement when your name is Harry von Tiltzer.
Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and for this round, the marks will go to whichever explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir, and people who live in glass houses should never throw stones.
Some 18 years ago, when I bought my present house, I searched for about a year and then was offered this place in the village I now live, Thorpe, which is about 19 miles from London. And it's not a glass house, which is perhaps fortunate as we live within a stone's throw of the village school. I searched for about a year, and I went to this London agency of an enormous, well-known store, and a gentleman called Cyril Chichester Fish was their estate agent dealing with this part of the Green Belt. A limp figure in well-cut tweeds. He had his brogues up on the desk and was oiling a 12-bore shotgun when I arrived. He said, Ducky, I think I can fix you up. And he gave me a whole lot of phrases describing this house. He said, in a leafy backwater, there's reasonable access. It has a charm entirely of its own. All mod cons, kitchen garden. Spacious lawns, recently modernized. Of solid period construction. Airy main bedroom with magnificent view. I thought, beautiful, and bought it. Whereupon I was bewitched, bothered, and bewilderness. I can now, after 18 years, give you a glossary of what these terms mean. In a leafy backwater means the kitchen door is 3 yards from a stagnant ditch. Reasonable access means that you are 2 miles from the village bus stop. And when you get there, the bus does not go to anywhere you would ever wish to go. A residence of character means that it has an identifiable but unlocatable smell. All mod cons, kitchen garden, means all the modern conveniences are in the kitchen garden. spacious lawns means that couch grass is growing up through the oggin. Recently modernized means that somebody has just put a plastic seat in the outside loo. Of solid period construction means rising damp in all walls, owing to the fact that there's no damp course. And lastly, airy main bedroom with magnificent view means half the roof's fallen in. Well, I bought this house, and about a week after we moved in, 18 years ago, I was terribly keen on village activities and started the Village Dramatic Society, the Thought Players, and we had our first meeting. We put glass in some of the windows and put sacking over the others, made the place look really nice, you know, and boarded up the hole in the ceiling. And somebody had promised us a harmonium and the loan of a footlight. So we were doing Oklahoma. Well, it wasn't all that different. There's a cast of about 50 people. We obviously had to give them some sort of refreshments halfway through. So we bought a crate of broken biscuits and explained that we had dropped them on the way. And an urn which we filled with 10 gallons of instant coffee. Okay. I was pushing it across the hall, and suddenly I realized that I'd left one thing out of this sad catalogue of the house, and that's dry rot in the floorboards. The rear wheels of the trolley sank through the floor. The trolley canted over, and 10 gallons of boiling hot coffee filled my gumboots. I was playing the part of Judd. Well, I was lying on my back with my feet above my head for 2 weeks when I had enough strength to ring Cyril Chichester Fish to complain. And I said, really, this has gone too far. This is absolutely ridiculous. He said, now what's the complaint this time? I said, the hall has dry rot. He said, it can't have, lovey. It can't have. I said, I am lying in a bed of pain. I've got what the medical profession calls boiled feet. And I said, I'm in agors. And he said, how did it happen? I said, the floorboards gave way. I was pushing this urn of coffee. He said, you were what? I was pushing it. He said, but lovey, the house I sold you was a house of character. It was a house of class. You don't go shoving round tea urn, ducky. I said, so, are you trying to tell me something about that house? He said, well, yes, quite frankly, I am. You must realise, love, people who live in class houses should never fast urns.
Terrible slur on Frank's very nice house. We go on to Dennis Norden's quotation. Wait till the sun shines, Nelly.
We receive many letters from listeners about this programme. Some are angry, some are complaining, some are downright abusive, but some... Well, no, come to think of it, that covers all of them. The most frequent complaint, however, is about these stories that Frank and I tell at the end of the programme. If I may quote a typical letter, you two make me sick to the pit of my stomach, writes one ardent fan. Why are Frank Muir's stories always about his house in Thorpe, his rotten dramatic society, and his putrid Afghan hound, while Dennis Norden's are always some despondent sordidness about his early sex life. According to the Radio Times, this programme is supposed to deal with literary matters. Signed, Mrs. J. Longland, Derbyshire. Mrs. Longland. Let me assure you that we try to give these stories a literary flavour. But what you must realise is we are at the mercy of these quotations that they give to us. It's not that we don't want to get onto the literary kick. For years, I have been saving a terrific literary anecdote about Gertrude Stein, the American lady poetess of the 20s. Now, this was a lady who was pot pals with Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Jean Cocteau. You can't get literarier than that. And I have this story about the day when she was about to cross the road and suddenly stopped because she felt an irritation on her nose. And as she stopped, a lorry belted round the corner and hurled right over the spot where she would have been standing if she hadn't paused to scratch. Now, I think that story is as literary as anybody would ever want. But if I'm not given the appropriate quotation in which to frame it, there is no way that I can tell you how an itch in time saved Stein. It's the same with Oliver Goldsmith. Now, as a fascinating literary figure, Oliver Goldsmith, stoned to the gills every day of his life. Yet every night when he came home, this is a literary fact, his wife would be waiting on the doorstep, no matter how drunk he was. And the minute he arrived, she'd belt him round the ear with this rolling pin and continue belting him until he fell to the floor unconscious and insensible. Now, what is the good of this moment of literary insight if no one allows you to use the phrase, she conks to stupor? You see, that is why I was so pleased with this week's quotation. At last, I have been given a chance to tell you about Lord Byron. And if he's not literary, Mrs. Longland, then I just give up the whole thing and take my chances in the Miss World contest. Lord Byron, mad, bad, dangerous to know, living in Rome, in self-imposed exile, surrounded by his private menagerie and six Italian mistresses. Poor fellow. Deserted by all his friends, save one. Dear, doomed Shelley. Percy Bysshe Shelley, 1792 to 1822. I hope you're taking notes of this, Mrs. Longland. So glad were the two friends to see each other again when Percy arrived in Rome that they chattered non-stop from the moment that Shelley alighted from his coach until they had arrived in the foyer of the hotel where Percy was booked to stay. And so eager was Percy to ply Byron with all the questions that he hadn't asked him for so many years that all unconsciously he elbowed aside from the hotel register none other than the Mother Superior of the Holy Order of St. Francis de Menica, who was waiting to sign him. This uncharacteristic lack of gallantry drew a sharp reproof from the noble Byron. Hang on, Percy said. Mind who you're shoving. At least, that is what he would have said had I not had this fortunate quotation this week. As it is, now cop this, Mrs. L, for your literary scrapbook. What I can now tell you, what Lord Byron said, was, wait till the nun signs Shelley.
And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless the other team of Dillis Power and Frank Muir win this entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶